Welcome to the Art Scene, presented each week by UANR Public Radio. Oboists Lorraine Duzo-Kitz and Leanna Bose and Beth Wheeler English Horn have a very busy spring, appearing as the trio and as soloists in a number of concerts between now and May. Commissioned by the trio is a work by exciting composer Stephanie Berg. This music is from the opening movement, which was premiered on January the 25th on Under the Dome Concert Series, first United Methodist Church in Conway, then again on February the 12th in the Harding University Classical Music Series. It will be heard by Little Rock audiences on the March 3rd River Rhapsodies concert, when the composer Stephanie Berg will be on hand. She joined Beth Wheeler and me by phone a few days ago, and the two of them traced the passage of the creation of the Featherlight Ballet.
It was commissioned by the DDG Trio.
The friendship between you and Stephanie, how did that start?
I learned of Stephanie through her fiancé, Tim Weddle, who is a bass player who was playing with the Arkansas Symphony at the time. And the musicians of the orchestra were going through the process of finding the composer to take our commission for the gift back to the board of directors. And Tim said, you know, my girlfriend's a composer. And I said, that's nice. That's very nice. But then I went to Stephanie's website and I said, oh my gosh, she writes gorgeous, fantastic, wonderful, interesting, very, very creative music. And so that's when we started talking about the possibility of Stephanie writing a piece for the trio.
But you are a performer as well, aren't you, Stephanie?
I am, yeah. I got to actually meet Beth, I believe it was last September. They called me in to play The Rite of Spring, called me down, and I was ecstatic. Dream come true right there. But, you know, then I got to meet Beth and meet the trio, and it was just a really great thing.
From that particular connection then, all this has sort of sprouted, as you might say. What did you have in mind when you finally got the assignment? And you had heard or spoken to Beth. Had you heard her play? Had you heard the DDG play before?
I hadn't heard the trio play specifically, but I had heard them play with the orchestra before. So I sort of was familiar with the performing forces I was working with. It was a bit of a challenge, really, writing for that ensemble. I tend to be a fairly bass-heavy writer. Eventually, you know, ideas came to me, and I'm extremely pleased with what came out. I would rank it as one of my best pieces. I'm extremely proud of it, and I'm extremely happy that I was able to produce one of my best works for this particular ensemble, and I think they're just tearing it up.
Well, it's got a lovely title, The Featherlight Ballet, and I wondered what gave that title to the piece. Was it in your mind as you were writing it?
Sometimes when I title pieces, sometimes I know the title immediately. Sometimes the title comes first. Other times, it's like the very last thing that occurs. And this was one of those pieces. I was having a really hard time thinking of what to call the piece. And I kept coming back to the words Featherlight Ballet. Mostly, it just kind of sounds like the piece. You know, something that's very light and delicate and very dance-like. Kind of encapsulated some of the grace was part of the work, and I thought it was a very evocative and poetic title, so I went with that.
Having written it, has it been played before, or will this be the first performances of it?
The DDG Trio is performing the first, they are premiering the work. I believe it was, the world premiere was on January 25th, I believe.
That's right.
And then they have another concert in February and then another one in March, which I will actually be attending.
Now, the other pieces that you have marked for the DDG, is that each one of those going to include Stephanie's piece?
Well, we performed it once already, a Sunday or so ago in Conway, in the First United Methodist Church and their Under the Dome concert series. March 3rd in the River Rhapsodies series, and Stephanie will be in attendance for that concert. We're very excited about that, and I think she'll probably speak a few words to the audience before we perform. I think the title actually came in very handy for programming purposes, because on the River Rhapsodies performance, Vladim Guzman is going to be the artist of distinction, and one of the pieces he's going to play is by Auerbach, and it's called Ballet for a Lonely Violinist. So I think there's a ballet theme going on that program.
Yes, and anytime you link dance with other pieces, it's, again, a,
another dimension in the mind of the listener sometimes mm-hmm. is imagining how that would look mm-hmm. on a stage.
Yes.
And when you write a piece of music, Stephanie, what images do you have in your mind?
You know, that's a really good question. It varies from piece to piece. A lot of times, you know, I envision kind of swirling colors, you know, general motions and general emotions. My music tends to be very evocative of, you know, stories and things like that, although I personally rarely envision, like, specific storylines to my pieces. I like to leave that up more to people that listen to it. But mostly I listen for the form and the proportion of the pieces and the activity of it. These Featherlight Ballet, you know, it's all about swirling colors and really highlighting the strengths of the ensemble, highlighting all the wonderful things that oboes can do and trying to show them in their best light.
And have you given pieces or given each one of the three in the trio a specific theme or voice of the movement that would be distinctive in a way that you feel is not exactly typical, but more comfortable for the individual musician? The English horn is so distinctive. Two oboes are equally, you would like them each to have a time in the spotlight, as it were.
Yes, that was one of my main focuses of this work, was to make sure that everybody had an equal part in it. And it really brought a lot of challenges, but also I think it really brought the piece to light, you know, allowing everybody, thinking of everybody in equal terms, equal footing.
Then the music itself, does it have a thematic link between each of the movements?
Slightly. I designed the first movement to be standalone movement if they chose to play it by itself. The DDG trio had mentioned that they were kind of looking for a short piece that they could possibly use as kind of a theme song, you know, a nice exciting opener for concerts and things. So I designed the first movement to fit that if they choose. The second movement is not thematically related to the first movement, but it was a compositional challenge for me. I wanted to see how much I could do with very little. So the theme of the second movement is really just two notes going back and forth. And it was a scary movement for me to write because all of the music of that movement comes from the performers themselves, you know, and that was me trying to allow. And then the last movement is, again, its own thing. But at the end of the third movement, I bring back material from the first movement as well, that just kind of puts a nice button on everything.
So the voices come together in a very satisfying statement, as it were.
Yeah, it sort of summarizes a little bit of everything, and yeah. I was very satisfied with it.
So what started you on this combination of performer and composer? Was it simultaneous on each, that as you grew into the instrument, as you matured, that you found that the compositional temptation was getting stronger?
Actually, that's not too far from the truth. I started as a clarinetist. I was determined I was going to be a clarinet performer. I'd always dabbled in composition. It was something that I had, you know, taken an interest in, but only as a hobby. And it wasn't until late in my undergraduate degree program that I started taking composition classes. And it was starting to become clear that I had a knack for composing, and eventually it's sort of taken over. I still perform quite a bit, but composing is quite a large part of what I do at this point, and I'm very pleased with it. It brings a never-ending list of new challenges and exciting prospects and things, and so it's been a real pain.
To get a little bit of insight into something that is being created is always fascinating for me, to know how you do it and why you do it. And as you said, how it finally turns out, it may not be exactly what you had in mind when you started.
Usually I'm pretty good about coming up with the main theme that I'm going to work with, you know, and that's very much inspired by something. The part that I get down quickly, and then I'm enthused about the piece, and then I have to think about the rest of the piece, and that's where it gets hard. So that's where my compositional training comes in, thinking about compositional techniques to develop themes and to fill out a piece and to really bring it to life, bring the thematic material to the ultimate iteration of itself. It's some pieces are easier to do than others. There are certain pieces that I have just struggled with endlessly, and other pieces that I've, you know, turned out in a week or two. So it just depends, I guess.
Sort of as you're speaking, I'm thinking of having some kind of a framework that you can sketch out as you start something and then find out where the pieces best fit on that particular framework. To start, have a beginning and an ending and a peak in the middle, and then sort of use that basis, discard some of it, but find that other pieces, thematic material, can be used in different ways, you know, back to front and upside down.
Well, that actually is largely how I structure my works. I think in terms of the arc structure, story arc type thing. You know, you have your introduction, building action, then you have the climax and usually the end of the piece or declining action or what have you, you know, and I'll play around within that framework, but I always tend to have the large scale form in mind whenever I'm writing, and it also depends on the time, the duration of the piece as well. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's dictated to me. A group may come to me and say, "We want a piece that's so long or so short," or you know, it may be up to me as well, and then I have to decide how long I want the piece to be, and that can help me figure out the pacing of it. You know. Is this the section where things need to really start rising to the climax, or is it too soon for that? And so those are all decisions that I have to make, you know, sort of as I'm writing it. And one of the strangest things to me is, as a composer, is making those decisions at all. You know, whenever I'm writing a piece, I'm basically creating music that has never, ever been heard before and that even I haven't heard before, and yet I can tell when I've written a wrong note.
Interesting.
And I don't know how I know that, but I was like, no, that C sharp there does not belong. It needs to be something different, you know. And there was one piece in particular that I was just really struggling with writing, and I knew all the wrong notes, but I couldn't figure out the right ones.
So
very frustrating. But I sat there and kind of mused about that for a little bit. I was like, well, I know that what I'm writing isn't correct yet, you know.
You don't put them all into like a bucket and shake them and see what comes out.
Yeah. Honestly, sometimes that might be the best way to go.
Now, when you first started this, did you, Beth, did you have questions from Stephanie that she was trying to get some kind of feedback while she was writing on it? Did you get that impression that you were being very much in her mind, that she wanted to make sure that what was going to come out would be something that you, the three of you, would really like?
Well, as I recall, the framework that we gave to Stephanie was we were looking for a piece in the 10-minute length range. Of course, we gave her the instrumentation of two oboes and English horn. As Stephanie said, we said we were looking for a movement that could be sort of a standard concert opener for us. Beyond that, I don't think we had too many specific requests, other than we did request that Stephanie keep in touch with us during the compositional process and just keep us informed and, you know, let us know what was going on, just because we were so excited about the project. We wanted to learn all about it. And I think, Stephanie, what I remember getting from you during that time is that you were excited, that you felt like it was coming along well, that there were some tunes that you and Tim were whistling frequently. Can you think of anything else that we talked about during the process?
I do remember asking specifically. I believe I sent you an excerpt of some technical passages, and I wanted to make sure that they were actually playable. And I remember you assuring me, I think it's Leanne.
Leanna, A-I-G.
It was an extremely high passage, and I know on the clarinet, you know, when you're playing at the top of the range, that's the fingering combinations get very creative, you know, and it's not necessarily a a very facile range. Concerned about that, I was like, did I just write something impossible? And I remember you assured me that, no, she's a pro at that stuff. So
yeah, she really is kind of a high note specialist.
Yeah.
So when you sent the piece in more or less completion form, you felt comfortable straight away with the piece when you got it?
When we first got the piece, I think I went through it and just clarified a few points about making sure that pitches and articulations, that I understood what Stephanie wanted from us. It's not an easy piece to play. It's a very easy piece, I think, to listen to. It's great fun to play. It is challenging, but it's a lot of fun, and it is very lively. Stephanie mentioned all the rhythms. The rhythms are great fun and very energetic. And the middle movement, as Stephanie said, it's really pretty. It's just, she said, two notes. It's a minor third, which is one of my favorite intervals. And it just goes back and forth, a little conversation initially between the English horn and the first oboe. And then it just morphs and takes off into this kind of rhapsodic melody. And there's to me, the climax of the piece is about two-thirds of the way through the middle movement, when we all just were soaring in range and dynamic, and there's some great harmonic tension that's resolved, and I think it's just a wonderful, wonderful addition to the repertoire, and I couldn't be happier.
That was Beth Wheeler, the English horn member of the DDG Woodwind Trio, with Stephanie Berg, composer of the Featherlight Ballet. Here is the beginning of that middle movement. That is the opening to the second movement of the Featherlight Ballet by Stephanie Berg. Premiered January the 25th in Conway in the First United Methodist Church Under the Dome series, and will be heard again March the 3rd on the next ASO River Rhapsodies concert. In the meantime, Beth Wheeler will join pianist Linda Holzer on February the 22nd in a performance of Suite from an Imaginary Opera by John Steinmetz. And information on that program will be coming up in just a few minutes. Stay tuned. Pianist Linda Holzer's next recital broadens yet again the scope of music and composers she brings to her programs, introducing this time what she refers to as the celebration of the new and known, a celebration of works by jazz great Bill Evans, A Touch of Beethoven, and contemporary composers Augusta Reed Thomas, John Steinmetz, and Lowell Lieberman. As always, carefully thought out, she gives the reasons for her choices.
I'm very excited about the upcoming concert Ear Opener, a celebration of the known and the new.
Have you mulled over it for a while when you've heard people or have heard of works such as one that Beth Wheeler suggested to you for the Steinmetz, that you wait until you've got a bouquet, as you might say, to put together?
Yes, that's a lovely image. I've actually owned scores for a couple of Lowell Lieberman's piano nocturnes and the score for the flute sonata for some time. Diane McVinney and I met a number of years ago when we were both featured performers for the Little Rock Musical Coterie. And so when Beth Wheeler suggested that we collaborate on the English horn and piano piece Suite for an Imaginary Opera, I immediately thought of Diane for the flute sonata by Lieberman as a really nice companion piece to have two woodwinds on the second half. Flute and then an English horn piece.
So what particular composer was the basis for this? Was it the Steinmetz?
No, really the basis was the Beethoven.
Well, I was wondering about that, yes. Because it sort of sticks out, Mr. Beethoven. But Beethoven, you can probably find something to fit with any program you put together.
You can, because late Beethoven is very much ahead of its time. And the Bill Evans piece, the opener piece, is very atmospheric and improvisational in a similar way to Beethoven's Opus 109.
Mm.
So even though they're from different time periods, by composers who didn't necessarily know one another, there's a kinship there in the writing, in the creative process, I would say.
That was the first two pieces more or less established when you were thinking of what else to put with them.
Yes.
And then you mentioned that Beth Wheeler had suggested a Steinmetz. So what is this? It's got a delightful title, the Steinmetz that you'll be playing.
Yes, Suite from an Imaginary Opera. And John actually provides very detailed notes for the performers and the audience, and I'm including them in the concert program. He speaks of the fact that many operas start optimistically and end in tragedy, but this piece imagines the opposite trajectory, beginning in pessimism or depression and working towards a happy ending. And of course, it's just Beth and I. There's no singing, and we are not in costume. It's an imaginary opera.
But is it to a particular text, or did the composer create the text as well?
There's no text because there's
story.
Nothing sung there's no story. The movement headings are gently suggestive, and the audience, the listeners, come up with their own story. The first movement is aria, the next movement dance, the next recitative, then an aria, so lyrical and lovely, featuring soaring lines for the English horn, and then closing with apotheosis. John touches on what you're asking about in his program notes. He says, what the story is, and whether it's a drama between people or a struggle within a single person, are questions for the audience's imaginations.
Hmm.
Correct. So we look forward to the audience taking it in and making up their own stories.
Yes.
As
and
it were.
Then in turn, times come, maybe he'd be interested to see what sort of stories were being evoked in the different memories or minds of the listeners.
Indeed.
So, that is a fairly busy beginning with only two composers, so it must be a fairly demanding first half.
Oh, yes. And the Beethoven is a lengthy piece,
you know,
as Beethoven sonatas tend to be.
Is there as much melody in it as there is in some of his other compositions?
It's really rather improvisational.
Now, is that a sonata for one, for yourself alone?
Yes.
Or is it, it's not
it's a solo piano sonata.
Which is, as you say, being long, is fairly demanding, so...
It is.
So let me think now. Then the other voices that you've chosen to add to the... did I ask you? What are the instruments in the first piece? Did you tell me?
The first piece is piano solo as well. Bill Evans' piece is piano solo.
So you take the first half.
I take the first half, and also the first piece on the second half is piano solo.
Love twitters. It doesn't sound like a solo piece.
but it is. And it is not a reference to social media. This is not Twitter as in the thing that people do on their phones. It's a really thoughtful piece by Augusta Reed Thomas. She lists it as being composed by Irving Berlin _ Augusta Reed Thomas. And the asterisk is for Irving Berlin's piece from Annie Get Your Gun, They Say It's Wonderful, which is about falling in love. And Love Twitters doesn't directly quote a lot of material from the Irving Berlin song, but it certainly refers to parts of it. And it's just very peripatetic, very
It's sort of a background music of birds in trees while the piano plays on something else.
Yeah, it's a very excited piece, reminiscent of falling in love.
Uh-huh. And she dates it 2006, which is quite a long time before they had things like Twitters on your telephone.
I suppose, yes.
I don't think some of those social media got quite as...
That could very well be.
Pervasive.
Yes.
As they are now. So the rest of it, the rest of the two pieces, are bringing in the other players on the program, with you accompanying the English horn on the suite from an imaginary opera we just talked about.
Yes.
Do the instruments speak?
Well, the instruments have very distinctive voices. Yes, they do. And it's a collaboration, really. The piano part and the English horn part each have leading roles at times, you know, just as the characters in an opera would take the stage in different scenes.
So there's a break between each of the so-called movements that he has listed.
One of the movements moves on without pause.
But the aria is like an introduction, like an overture. Would you, if you tried to sort of imagine where the imaginary opera was taking shape?
Yes, the piano part at the start of the first movement is like an overture. Yes. Setting the stage.
Yeah. Then do the instruments have their own voice in a specific movement, or are they together on all the movements?
Oh, they're together on all the movements, yeah.
It sounds... I'd be interested to hear what this sounds
like. Oh, yes. Yeah. And we're having a lot of fun playing it. For Beth, it's a piece she's done before, and for me, it's a new piece.
Which is always exciting.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Particularly with you being piano, what voices, what instruments come in with it is either dictated by the composer, or the composer allows the musicians playing his or her piece to play a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, your friend, Miss Thomas.
Yes.
Does she do that? You know, come up with something like Love Twitters, write it sort of directions, as so many composers do on their scores, or does she allow you to embellish a little?
No, she's quite specific in her score about what she wants the performers to do. And I would say Lowell Lieberman, similarly, they're quite detailed in what they're after. And there's always a certain amount of the performer's imagination that comes into play to a point, but it's within the parameters that the composer has set.
Yeah. Do you have fun putting this sort of a program together?
Oh, absolutely. It is a very special pleasure planning a concert program, and there are many facets to it.
Mm-hmm. Do you have like a cornucopia of choices?
Well, yeah, being a pianist, there's just reams of stuff that's been written for either piano solo or piano with other instruments. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as your career unfolds and you get to know colleagues in your area and just nationwide, that expands the realm of possibilities as well. And I feel so fortunate that this combination of pieces and personnel is coming together this month.
Pianist Dr. Linda Holzer is professor of music and coordinator of classical piano studies at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. The program features special guests Beth Wheeler, English horn, and Diane McVinnie, flute, in a concert with selections from jazz great Bill Evans and contemporary American composers Augusta Reed Thomas, John Steinmetz, and Lowell Lieberman, 3 p.m. on Sunday, February the 22nd, in the Stella Ball Smith Concert Hall at UALR. The concert is free and open to the public. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR Public Radio.